From the Vault, a true crime podcast, is a production of JPF Productions and Bebo Studios. All opinions stated are those of the podcast and its hosts and are not to be considered factual. Any facts related to today's case has been backed up by resources provided in the description for the podcast. Enjoy the show. Hello listeners, Jason Futch here, and I want to bring to everyone's attention a very cool true crime podcast that's out there, Crime Time Nerds, a sister podcast. It is hosted by sister-in-laws Nat and Ash as they share cold cases from their home state of Vermont. But don't let that fool you, because they also talk about cases from across the United States and around the world. As a matter of fact, I was just recently a guest on their podcast as me and my colleagues from the Fenley Creek Jane Doe Task Force discussed the case of Fenley Creek Jane Doe and her unborn child that was buried in the hills of eastern Oregon in the late 1970s. Check them out. They are awesome. You can listen to them wherever you listen to your podcast. And you can also find them on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in Crime Time Nerds and they pop up right there. So go ahead, check them out. Really cool podcast, and I highly encourage everyone to listen. Hello, and welcome to another episode of From the Vault, right here on Anchor and wherever you can find your favorite podcast. I'm Jason Futch, and I want to thank you all for listening in as Nick and I continue the conversation about Reet Sylvia Gervetsa, a 19-year-old woman who disappeared from Los Angeles, California in November of 1969, only to be found dead on November 14th of 1969. And for the longest time, she was considered a Jane Doe, for well over 40 years, in fact. And her official case file name was Jane Doe number 59. Now, in the previous episode, Nick and I were talking about her life as an Estonian immigrant who moved to Canada with her family when she was very young. She grew up in Canada, and then she moved to Toronto at a young age, and then she immigrated at 19 years old to Los Angeles, where it was assumed she lived with a man named John, or Jean, depending on what part of the country you're in. But nonetheless, this was the assumption that she lived with her boyfriend, so to speak. This was the man that she was living with. And then she was never heard from again by her family. And they never reported her missing because they had assumed that, you know, she went on to do bigger and better things. And, well, she just, simply moved on. But little did they realize that she met a very unfortunate end when she was discovered in November of 1969 with many stab wounds on her body. In the first half of the show, we were talking about the investigation and how she was found. And among other things, we were also talking about a similar case involving Marina Habe. We also briefly touched up on the possibility that Charles Manson was involved in this homicide. Now, as we continue this conversation into Reet's case, Nick begins to talk about the Sharon Tate homicide. And I'll keep everyone in mind that the reason this started was because there was a rumor surrounding at the time of this case that Charles Manson and his cult, who were residing at Spahn Ranch, was involved in this homicide because it was very eerily similar to some of the murders that occurred under the Manson family, like multiple stab wounds, the viciousness. However, they never disposed of any of their victims in the woods. In fact, they had made their crimes very evident based on a number of factors. In fact, it was as if they wanted investigators to find these bodies. And then on top of that, they were using the victim's blood to write messages on the wall. Paul's, and pretty much all of Manson's cases, these murders were very savage. So we do pick up here as Nick starts talking about Sharon Tate, and then we just keep flowing through the conversation. And in this episode, we do talk about that, some more theories that are involved in this case. And then we go into the later years where investigators do find DNA for Reed's case. And then the big reveal, who was Jane Doe number 59? All of that and more on this episode of From the Vault. But before we continue to the episode, I want to remind everybody that today's episode is brought to you by Crime Watchers in pursuit of the missing, the unidentified, and justice. Every case that we cover on an episode of From the Vault, including Reed's case, can be found there. And you can join in on the discussion. So go ahead, sign up for a free account. That's www.crimewatchers.net. And go ahead, start talking about some of these cases and more. So go ahead, sign up for that free account, and you'll be on your way to chatting up about true crime. Other than that, folks, I want to go ahead and continue the conversation. Nick, take it away.
So, and to kind of move forward, shift gears towards considering Mulholland Drive, 4 months before Reed was killed in August, everybody is very well aware of how three of Manson's followers killed Sharon Tate, her unborn son, and three other individuals. It's something that has remained a very infamous, and it's popularly talked about 50-some years after the fact. One thing especially that is interesting, not only has this been brought up by family and friends of Reet, as well as investigators, is that Sharon Tate and Reet Gervetson looked a lot alike. When you compare their photos side to side, you know, they're very similar. Even when you look at photos of Marina Habe, she even herself bears a resemblance to Sharon Tate, especially. But, you know, at the same time, I know, like, you're especially leaning a little more towards Manson's involvement in Reet's death, but to me, the one thing that really makes me much more resistant to that is the fact that the murders of Sharon Tate and the other individuals at that scene, they were meant to be found. They were meant to be discovered in a horrific way. You know,
there was a message to be sent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They were intended to be found in a horrible condition. It really, quite honestly, infuriates me that there are crime scene photos available online. That could be a whole different podcast right there. But because of the fact that that crime scene was always meant to be found, I'm sort of feeling that might potentially interfere with any kind of connection with Reet's case. Yes, you know, this happened along Mulholland Drive, as we saw with, you know, Rose Tashman's case. There are crimes along this infamous road, you know, that are linked solely based on the location and circumstances that are much different as far as the deaths go. And I truly feel like with the fact that whoever killed Reet did not want her to be found, that, you know, his intention was to get rid of her body quickly, drop it over the side of that embankment late at night. And just the fact that he was not intending to necessarily send a message to anybody with this murder. You know, this, to me, with all the overkill, this seems like it's a very personal crime, that this was either done by somebody who wanted to take revenge for being wronged, or if this could have been a serial killer who might have somehow subconsciously likened Reet to another figure that had wronged him in the past. That has been a common MO for other serial offenders. That, yeah, this might not have been a Manson involvement.
Yeah, as you put it that way, definitely I could see where you're coming from on this. Like I just mentioned earlier, this was the late 60s in Los Angeles. Anything could have really happened regarding a lot of these women that you mentioned here. Yeah, I mean, you got a point there. I think, honestly, I might retract my statement about Manson. But I will say this, though. I do find it a little ironic, just a little ironic, that a lot of the victims in this case share similar features to some of Manson's followers and some of Manson's victims. And, you know, as we kind of touched up on a little earlier with Marina, some speculated that she may have been associated with the Manson family, but that has not been confirmed nor denied. So it's something. And then on top of that, we're also hearing about Reet, where Reet herself was possibly seen with Manson. This was another thing, too, was that some people thought they saw her with Manson, and she was being referred to as Sherry. Which, remember, folks, we have to remember at this point, we don't know this is Reet Gervetson yet. We only know her as a Jane Doe. When this rumor started circulating that she may have been a Manson follower, she was dubbed Sherry, because that was the name that some of the witnesses heard her referred to as by members of the Manson clan. So that is why I initially kind of connected this case to Manson, because it makes sense in some way. You know, you have a girl who just came into the United States looking to find her way. What better prey than someone who does not have a set end game yet? You know what I mean? I mean, What better prey than to get someone vulnerable? And for Charles Manson, this would have been a perfect member of his flock, wouldn't you agree?
I think, yeah, you know, based on the fact that, you know, she was a very attractive woman. She was in California. She was very far away from where she grew up. I think, yeah, she would have been definitely somebody he would have selected.
Right.
And with the whole eyewitness story, too, it seems like there's a lot of different details. I've even heard, too, that this potential Sherry figure might have actually been identified as somebody else who was alive and well. I'm not 100% sure as to where I uncovered that information. But yeah, I still do remember that while Reet was still unidentified and looking at her file, her information on the Doe Network and other websites, the names Reet and Sherry don't necessarily immediately sound the same. But, you know, there is a chance that somebody could have misheard it and thought they heard Sherry instead of Reet. We just really can't determine whether or not she was involved with Manson or not.
Oh, certainly. And, you know, and before we continue, because I don't know when we're going to talk about Charles Manson again, I do kind of want to chat real fast about the Sharon Tate murder, too. There are some differences, I will admit here, between the previous three victims that we were talking about and Sharon Tate, and then also her company, which was Jay Sebring, Waj Frykowski, and Abigail Folger. She was very pregnant, like super, super, super pregnant. In fact, some of the last photos that were ever taken of her, she was in that very almost latter stage of pregnancy. When she was murdered, her son was killed with her because of how aggressive members of Manson's family, so-called family, murdered her. And then also when we're talking about Jay Sebring, Waj Frykowski, Abigail Folger, as you mentioned, Nick, it's very unfortunate that there are crime scene photos floating around of these victims. But one of the big things I noticed too was with the Tate murders, there were male victims. And yeah. Abigail Folger, who does not resemble any of these girls in any way. I think this could have been just completely something altogether, and the three that were murdered with Sharon and her son were just a victim of happenstance. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, if these murders are connected, all of them connected to the Manson family, that is a chance. The fact that there were three offenders going into a house, you know, that had several people in it, and that they carried out the crime, it was premeditated, of course, at least with Reet's case. It doesn't seem like there was anybody else involved with her murder. I guess, obviously, with Marina Habe's case, she was abducted by at least two people, as I mentioned before. That might be more likely to be connected to the Manson killings in Reet's case. I believe I'll admit that, too. Another thing, too, is that Charles Manson did deny involvement in Reet's case before her identification. I mean, of course, he's a serial killer by proxy. He never killed anybody with his own hands, but he, of course, was the mastermind behind them. He wasn't obviously a credible source.
Oh, and one other thing, too, Nick, I should throw in. There was also one other victim named Stephen Parent.
Okay, so going back to Manson, when he was interviewed about a potential connection to Reet's case, he denied any involvement. He's not a credible source, of course, because, you know, he's
lunatic.
Charles Manson is this psychopath. He didn't necessarily kill anybody with his own two hands, but he was the mastermind behind it, which, you know, is referred to as murder by proxy. sometimes you do have to take those statements and those denials with a grain of salt. But one thing too is that after Reet's identification, fast forward to late 2015, he was interviewed again, and detectives even mentioned that he was not able to provide any information useful to that was useful to their investigation. They did say, though, that they have not conclusively eliminated Manson and his followers. They're not being labeled as suspects or even persons of interest, but they just can't be ruled out completely, which, as we've talked about before, that doesn't necessarily mean that is a stronger chance that they're involved. It's just like how we've talked about before, you know, it's just that it's been so long and there is, you know, really, without the forensic evidence, there's really no way to link them conclusively to Reet's case, to Marina's, to Rose's. It's all up in the air.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, too, is even though you've been ruled out as a suspect, it doesn't mean you've been completely ruled out. It just means that there's not sufficient enough evidence to consider you a strong suspect. But here's the thing. You can say that they've been ruled out, but at the end of the day, when you look at a police file, cold case or otherwise, their name is still going to be in the list of potential suspects. I mean, you're never 100% ruled out. There's always going to be an eye watching you. In this case, okay, granted, you know, we're talking about high-profile serial killer by proxy, but at the same time, just because you didn't do it doesn't mean you didn't do it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, now, even though, yeah, they questioned him about the murder even after the fact that they identified her, he was still no use to them. And he died in 2017, I believe. So now there's really nowhere to go with that lead. And then my question would be, here's my question in this, before we wrap up talking about Manson here, is I wonder if the suspects who were involved in the Tate case, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Charles Watson, I wonder if they were ever asked about Reet. Leslie Van Houten, I wonder if any of them had been asked about Reet or, you know, Marina and stuff like that.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that would be a very interesting bit of information. I honestly hope that if they were cooperative, that there were attempts. Investigators and detectives can't reveal every single thing they've done in the investigation to the public. But yeah, I think if in fact, you know, Reet and Marina had been around members of the Manson followers, that somebody would have confirmed or denied. And I know there is also the possibility that both Reet and Marina could have witnessed something they weren't supposed to see, whether it was at the hands of the Manson family or somebody else, and they were killed to conceal that.
Sure.
But at the same time, I feel like if Reet had witnessed something she wasn't supposed to, committed by the Manson family, they might have been a little more determined to at least put her in plain sight to send a message to anybody who is thinking about cooperating with investigators about the Manson killings. Mm-hmm. So, there's so much information to process. There's so many possibilities. But I guess, you know, to kind of turn the page away from the high profile murder of Sharon Tate and her company at the time, going ahead to the year 1970, this occurred nearly a year to the date that Reet was killed. A young woman named Robin Graham, who was 18, she was most likely abducted from a location that was near the site that Marina Habe's body had been discovered in December of 1968. Graham has never been located. And I guess, you know, when you look at her images that are, you know, posted online, I wouldn't say she resembles any of the others that we've talked about before. Again, just because of the similar location, it could be a possibility. But what I do also need to mention is that Robin's case is much more commonly linked to being a potential victim of the Zodiac Killer or the Santa Rosa Hitchhiker murder cases, neither of which have been solved. The offender in question has never been apprehended or identified. And like you said, you know, if you go back and you look at all of the disappearances and murders of young women in the late 1960s and early 70s, I mean, in Los Angeles County alone, you're going to have a lot. So it definitely could be a strong possibility that several of these cases aren't related, if, you know, also it's obviously a possibility that none of these cases could be linked. I know for me, with my research and my interest, I do really have a lot of tendencies to consider the possibility of a serial killer being involved, just because that is something I'm interested in with victimology and behavior and MOs. But this was definitely something I felt that was relevant to include here, that this alternate possibility that perhaps Reet was not killed by her significant other at the time.
Sure. I mean, you have to explore many possibilities in a case like this, especially when you have a number of other similar homicides happening in the area. And yes, not all of them are going to be linked, but at the same time, we can't necessarily rule it out. That's why we're doing what we're doing here on the podcast. We're exploring all the avenues. Well, maybe not all of them, but some of the avenues of what could have happened. And that's why we're kind of digging a little deeper into possible victims. So we're actually doing a little more in-depth research into the victimology of Reet's case, mm-hmm. which we can definitely compare to other cases here, including Marina Habe's case. Considering that their murders happened within close proximity, and then on top of that, they look alike almost.
Mm-hmm.
But, on that note, though, when we're talking about exploring options, that's exactly what the Los Angeles Police Department did. They went through new leads, they exhausted those leads, they went through another set of new leads, and then they exhausted those leads. I mean, you can only get so many leads before there's nothing to work with. And any police department in the United States can get 700 to 1,000 leads. And they can all be ruled out in a matter of days. And then law enforcement is left with nothing to go on. That's how quick tips can be ruled out.
Yeah, I definitely don't envy some of these investigators who are even, medical examiners and coroners who, get these numerous emails or phone calls from people, these internet sleuths they see a resemblance or a possible link to another missing individual for a John or Jane Doe. And, they probably get swamped with all of that, and it can get overwhelming, I'm sure. And,
absolutely.
I do feel like even though I've been kind of sharpening my sleuthing techniques and my knowledge on forensic science and comparison between a missing and unidentified person, that I still feel like, I'm sometimes still grasping at some certain connections I've made too. And I think everybody can agree that sometimes what they've come up with is something that's already been considered and dismissed, or may not even be relevant to the case, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah, and it is what it is, as I've said many times. I mean, honestly, a tip is a tip, whether it's good or bad. At least it gets an investigation moving in some kind of direction. And in Reet's case, especially considering Reet's case when she was a Jane Doe, was pretty popular amongst individuals who were in the web sleuths community and the crime watchers community. A lot of people were talking about Reet's case. You got people like Carl Koppelman, who did a couple of revisions on a reconstruction based on her morgue photo.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got police department artists trying to do a facial approximation on her as well. At least trying their best anyways, because you got to remember, before they retouched the morgue photo, they were working with a pretty bad photo of her dead body, assuming, rather. They had not a lot to go on until recent technology.
Yeah, and I remember even when I was watching videos and interviews, I remember when they were talking about their decision to release that morgue photo online, they really had to do a lot of extensive retouching because she had suffered a lot of trauma to her neck and upper body. And I know I particularly found that morgue photo to be disturbing even after it was retouched, just because her eyes were open. And seeing a deceased person with open eyes is something that's always disturbed me since I was young, back to the days when I was in middle school watching Forensic Files or doing, internet searches.
Sure.
And she'd gone through a lot of trauma and a lot of pain and horror. And a lot of times, too, a morgue photograph sometimes is not always the most accurate representation of the victim. And in this case in particular, that image, I'm unsure as to whether there were other photos of her face taken. It's taken at an angle where her head is sort of tilted over, and that can actually, impair some certain features. It's kind of an odd angle that a lot of people probably never would have seen Reet at necessarily. In this case, though, you know, which we're going to go on to later, that actually ended up not being the case. Regarding the forensic art that was put out, Carl's image was created on his own. He was not consulted to create that rendering, unlike a lot of the early sketches that are available online. I think one was, you know, from a newspaper clipping. There was another one that was done after her discovery. And then I know an artist that's affiliated with the Project Eden organization that Todd Matthews started, of forensic artists who would provide free reconstructions, did one as well. And I know her sister really gave some harsh criticism on those renderings.
Especially those Project Eden ones. God damn. Yeah. There's some of those. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and I definitely don't want to, I guess, overly criticize another artist, just because, you know, of course, we've all got our own training, and Project Eden's artists are all certified, and I'm definitely not going to get into that really any further. And, you know, Todd Matthews, I greatly respect him. Sure. So,
I will definitely be blunt out there, and I don't think it was actually the Project Eden group. It was another group out there who likes to really do campy facial reconstructions based on already made reconstructions, and some of them are just fucking awful. I mean, awful enough to give me nightmares. I've seen a few, and I'm sure we've talked about this in the past in several other episodes. Sometimes I just want to tell some of these artists, don't quit your damn day job, because this doesn't even look realistic. I mean, I don't even know if I would even call this a facial approximation. I don't know. And then when you get someone like Reet's family, as we're going to touch up on here later, it might be just borderline insulting to the family to do something like that, especially after the fact.
Yeah, and I've learned over the years too, a lot of the listeners might be, you know, familiar with Unidentified Wiki. I know I've been actually interested in forensic art since before I was even interested in true crime. I was always interested in archaeological mummies that were reconstructed, and I always thought that was really cool. I've experimented with that myself. I was actually, you know, kind of doing these amateur approximations for a while, and I ended up getting ripped a new one. At the same time, I was upset. An amateur-made approximation with no professional training, or, and on my part, you know, I can't draw worth for crap, so that's why I did more of a digital approach, but that could actually harm the investigation process, and that ultimately led to where most of the user-uploaded images, including mine, most of them have been removed just for that sake. I still have to say that forensic art, whether it's the composite of a suspect, whether it's a clay-based 3D reconstruction, if it's a very lifelike photographic approximation done by NCMEC or another organization, or if it's just a sketch that may or may not have been accurate to the victim in life, it still has to be approached with a very open mind. I still greatly empathize with Reet's family as far as, you know, commenting that it was difficult for them to see Reet in those images. But yeah.
Yeah. And going back to, you know, how LAPD, when they released those forensic reconstructions and approximations, that didn't even get them anywhere. As we were just discussed, I can kind of see why. But with that being said, sometime after her body was cremated, see, here's the thing about LA County, for everyone who doesn't know. If your body persists in either being unidentified or unclaimed, you're going to have a date with the oven, so to speak. You're taking up a lot of space in the morgue, and we got to do something with you. Someone's got to claim you. If no one wants to claim you, or if we can't even find an identification, we're going to have to cremate you, put you in a little box, and then put you in storage for a little while. And then if we can't identify you, or if no one wants to come and pick up your body, or, well, at this point, your cremains, we're going to go to one of the LA County cemeteries, dig a big old hole, and dump every single box of cremains in this big old hole and bury them all together. Only reason I know that is there is a movie on YouTube about that. I forgot the name of it, but Google it. It's a very interesting story. But on that note, Reet was no different. Or, at this point, Jane Doe number 59. It was no different for her. After a while, she was unclaimed. No one knew who the hell she was. They had to do something about it. And it's a little unfortunate because back then, law enforcement did not have one iota about DNA being a huge tool in solving crimes in the United States. To that consequence, and this goes for other cases in LA County that are still unsolved or individuals unidentified.
Absolutely.
In that consequence, there was no DNA collected. So at this point, the only thing basically they could identify her on are either dentals or fingerprints, or so they thought. Because one of the detectives made a huge discovery just by going through her case file. They found, well, a piece of DNA on some evidence in Reed's file. And that would actually provide a big key into this investigation. And that's where we get into her identification. In the summer of 2015, Ann Jurvetson, Reed's sister, reached out to the LAPD after a friend of Reed's viewed a retouched photograph of a woman's body on NamUs, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. Her friend informed her that the dead body in question resembled her long-lost sister, Reed, and that she should reach out to the LAPD and submit a DNA sample. After reaching out to the LAPD, Anne discovered that a blood-stained bra that was held in evidence allowed for them to maintain a DNA sample on file at LAPD. You gotta remember, that's a rare situation for a case that old to have DNA. Because once again, there was that little bit of non-understanding about DNA at the time. Because you gotta remember, DNA being used in a criminal investigation did not happen until the mid-80s. So we're talking 1969, long time before 1980. So a rare feat here. Thank God they kept evidence in Reed's case because of that blood-stained bra. And when they did get Anne's DNA, after she volunteered to submit it, we find out that this is indeed Reed Jurvetson.
And I remember seeing those, just how her two friends from Montreal were saying, upon seeing that image of Reed, that it had to be her. Not only did that morgue photograph resemble her, the jewelry that was found on her body was very consistent with what they had already known she'd worn. And Anne was interviewed too. You know, she was heartbroken and choking back tears. She knew what happened to Reed. Her family had always kind of thought that she'd gone off and lived her life because she was a free spirit, and she ultimately died shortly after going to the United States. And it's just, and her parents never found out what happened to her, and I'm sure most of her relatives too at the time who knew her have since passed, because this was 52 years ago, just about.
Right, and that's the thing, is no matter how old a case like this is, it's still very fresh in the memories of family members. And that was something that I learned, because very soon I'm going to be doing a new podcast. It's going to be called Suwannee Valley Unsolved, about cases in my particular area where I live. And I just recently wrapped up an interview with the daughter of Darlene Messer, a woman who had been abducted from a gas station she was working night shift at and was found in a creek nearby a few days later. Basically, Darlene was almost absent from her life, you know, other than several instances of seeing her and whatnot. But at the same time, at the end of the day, that was her mother. Doesn't matter how frequent she got to see her mother, it still is fresh to this day, even after 30 years. And so, you know, when I was interviewing her, she was very emotional. She was fighting tears. She broke down and cried. And I gave her that safe space, because it doesn't matter, like I said, how old a case can be. What happens is that sometimes some of the oldest cases can seem just like yesterday to someone who was personally affected by this tragedy. And I personally can't attest to that kind of shock and horror and grief, because I've never had a family member close to me get murdered or go missing. But in the last couple of years, I've interviewed a number of victims' family members, and I can empathize with them at least. You know, I can feel their pain, even though I personally never felt it. I can still feel that pain that they're mm-hmm. going through, the problems that they're going through. A perfect example would be Joanne Franks, Eric Franks' mother. That was a tough interview to do. I mean, she's still devastated. And on top of that, considering some of the recent drama in Eric's case, you can only imagine what she's going through, because she's got newfound hope that her son could be found. And it's just amazing to me how some of these individuals, despite the shit that they've gone through, are still so strong-willed that they've been able to push through all the bad shit and remember their loved one for the good person that they were. And that was something I recalled in Angela Tini's interview when I was talking to her about her mom, Darlene, is that she chooses to remember Darlene as her mother, not Darlene, the homicide victim. And that's something that we like to do on this podcast. We don't want to reflect on our subjects as victims. We want people to know who this individual was prior to her homicide, prior to her identification. We want people to know who the subject was, what kind of a person they were. Because at the end of the day, if you haven't listened to this podcast, or someone who doesn't listen to this podcast, all they're going to see is a mugshot and a synopsis of what happened on that day. They don't get to find out that Reet was an Estonian immigrant who lived in Canada with her parents for most of her life, who had dreams and aspirations of moving to California, and had great friends who loved her and family that loved her. No one gets to hear that story. No one. Unless you listen to a podcast like this, or you go on YouTube and you watch the CBC documentary, The Fifth Estate.
And yeah, and that's, you know, it's something that always bothers me too, is that once you're a victim, you're always a victim. To the families and the people who knew them in life, there's so much more than that. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, in future episodes, you know, if I am able to meet with people who have experienced this, I'm both terrified and looking forward to getting into who they were, and not just they're the fourth person to go missing in 2009. Yeah. But at the same time, the family's privacy is also something that needs to be prioritized as well.
Right.
So, yeah, that was another tangent. Sorry. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, okay. You're good. And that's the thing, too, is that when Reet's identified, you know, we learn a lot more about her and about her life. But then we also learn when Reet was not keeping in touch with the family had actually presumed she had either moved on with her life and was doing her thing, or maybe something bad may have happened to her. But nonetheless, you know, soon after they realized it's been a while since we heard from Reet, her parents soon became very concerned, and they had written a letter to the address that Reet had sent the postcards from. They would come back later, informing the parents that Reet had vacated the apartment. And then the family after that, because that only builds their concerns even greater, they also hire a private investigator to look into Reet's whereabouts. The problem is that the efforts ended up remaining fruitless and a waste of time and money. After that, there would be lots of rumor, lots of speculations, and unfortunately, that's all her parents would get, as well as her brother, who had passed away before she was identified. A formal announcement was made in April of 2016. Shortly after, investigators made a public call to help identify Reet's murderer. Specifically, they wanted to know, who is this Jean that Reet had moved in with in Los Angeles after leaving Montreal? Was he still alive? What did this man do after Reet died? Could he have been the one to write the Gervetsons, telling her parents that Reet vacated her apartment? I mean, there's so many questions that can be asked here.
Yeah, and nobody knows who he is. We've got, you know, approximate likenesses that have been released. She was absolutely crazy about him when she left Canada. And it's just very strange how he just disappeared off the face of the earth. He had moved out of the apartment as well at some point, and nobody knows where he went. Nobody knows who he is. He hasn't been labeled as a concrete suspect either, because, you know, we don't know enough, especially because of the amount of overkill in Reet's case. I still feel like, even though I brought up the possibility of connections to other cases, I still feel that he is probably the key to solving this case. I definitely see that it was very personal, that he was described as this Jim Morrison lookalike who was very good looking. It could have been a very big blow to his ego if Reet had made the decision to leave him. And you know, I'm sure he took a lot of pride with having such a beautiful woman holding hands along the sidewalks. And you know, if he wasn't used to that sort of a thing, it could have been motivation enough if she was the one who could have wanted to end things, or if something had happened as to that he viewed as threatening his ego. It's kind of difficult for me to necessarily make that assumption based on that. All we know is that he was her boyfriend and he looked like Jim Morrison. There's, yeah.
That's all we have. I mean, and that's the unfortunate part. We don't know who this guy was. There's no last name. As you said, all we know is he's a Jim Morrison lookalike who was with Reet at the time of her murder. So we really don't have much other than that. And that's very unfortunate. But however, all is not lost. Because listeners, if you know anything about this case, anyone in Los Angeles County who's listening to this show tonight, you have an opportunity to make a difference. I mean, granted, it's been a very long time. Your memory might be fuzzy. But just think for a minute. Think for just a minute. Do you remember seeing a suspicious vehicle parked on the side of the road on Mulholland Drive the evening before she was found, or whenever, around that same time frame? Do you remember anything at all about this? You have an opportunity to speak up and be heard. That's why I encourage you to reach out to the LAPD Cold Case Homicide Unit. Their phone number is 213-847-0970. Again, that's 213-847-0970, and reference case number 69-668-376. One more time, that's 69-668-376. And though Reet Gervetson has been identified, she's no longer Jane Doe 59 or Sherry Doe, whatever you want to call her. Even though she's been identified, her case still remains open. And unfortunately, it's very cold. And hopefully you might be the key in warming it up.
And it's definitely worth mentioning as well that if you have any idea as to who this Jean or John could have been, if he might have been someone you came across yourself in the late 60s, early 70s, or perhaps that mysterious or elusive uncle, father even, or a family friend. No matter how small a recollection might seem to someone who may have witnessed his activity, or to those who might have known him later in life, or even heard stories about a figure that could match his description, it's always important to bring that forward just in case, because we could go on and on about all of these cases that seemed hopeless that were ultimately solved because someone came forward with a memory that they thought was insignificant or just a small observation they made. It's always worth a shot to submit it because, you know, it might end up being the key.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And before we wrap up today's episode, I want to tell everybody that a lot of the resources that we got today on this episode was through the aforementioned documentary that Nick had mentioned a few times on this episode. It is called The Fifth Estate. It was created by CBC Canada, the news agency that is located in Canada. And it came out in 2016, but it had a treasure trove of information regarding Reet's case. It's about 20 minutes long, so if you have the time, go to YouTube, look up CBC The Fifth Estate, and you will find this episode on Reet Gervetson, and we'll link it as well on this podcast in the description, and we'll also link it on YouTube or on Facebook as well and Twitter. So with that being said, that is going to wrap up today's episode on Reet Gervetson. I think we did a pretty good job. What do you think?
Yeah, I initially didn't think it was going to go on this long, but I think we went over a lot of interesting details, and I think we did a pretty comprehensive episode. I think based on, you know, some of the information that we found and, you You know, of course, this is a well-covered case, so there's maybe some points we haven't touched on, but I still feel that we at least took into account humanizing Reet beyond a former Jane Doe and a victim, and I'm satisfied with that.
Absolutely, same here. So next week, we are going to be covering a Jane Doe case out of Tennessee. The Knox County, Tennessee Jane Doe. She's also known as Shotgun Jane Doe. She was found dead on Jim Sturchy Road after attempting to break into a house with two other men. And as you all might know about this case, she ended up kicking the door on the house, alerted the individuals, and well, but with that being said, she's still unidentified. People need to find out who this woman is because, you know, even though she may have done something bad and she was with a pretty shady group of individuals, she still deserves to be sent back home to her family. And this happened on June 1st of 1987. And we'll be going a little in depth on this case because we do have available police reports on this case. What do you think about this one, Nick?
This, to me, was a standout case just because this was a self-defense related death. The owner of the house did have every right to defend themselves because he didn't know what was on the other side of the door. At the same time, too, she was a person. She could have been a mother. She could have been a sister. She was somebody's daughter. It's been over 30 years, and we still don't know who she is. Everybody deserves to have their identity and to have the dignity of being buried where your family desires. Of course, in Reet's case, that is impossible, but to at least to the point where your family and your friends know what happened.
Yep, I completely agree with that. I'm very vocal when it comes to self-defense because I, you know, yes, and I will admit something about myself, some of y'all might not like. I am a Democrat, but I am also pro-Second Amendment, which you don't really necessarily hear in the same sentence. So
I will say I'm a very liberal person myself. Growing up with a Democratic mother and a Republican father, of course, I do feel like it's a little ridiculous that it's automatically assumed that any sort of regulation is automatically going to take away everybody's right to have a firearm. But obviously, everyone deserves the right to defend themselves. Everybody deserves to go hunting. Like you, I'm a Democrat, and I'm pro-Second Amendment. I do feel like the homeowner did deserve to make that decision, and it's unfortunately ended up being disastrous to this young woman and resulted in her death.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a touchy subject. I'm hoping that we can kind of maintain a balance with everything because, of course, our listeners are from different regions of the country and even the world. Everybody's got their own political viewpoints.
Yeah, I'm afraid that might actually end up being a topic of discussion while we're talking about the podcast, so we'll try to avoid it, but there's no guarantees. So for those of you who don't necessarily like political conversations in these kind of cases, this might not be one to watch, and you'll just join us on the next episode after that. But yeah, we'll be talking about her case, and also probably in the next episode as well, we're going to provide some updates on our scheduling about cases that we're going to be covering. I know throughout the last couple of weeks, some of you on our Facebook page have been seeing that we've added the Ken McElroy case to our lineup. And we're actually adding new cases as we go along because we're finding out that some of the episodes that we had planned to work on are not coming to fruition, and we'll admit that because some of it is because of personal reasons, trying to arrange it with the individuals who are working closely with us on it, and then also there might be some cases that we should not touch. So we'll provide an update on what we've got going on in the future. We do intend to take a break in May or June. We'll make that decision soon. And then we will go from there. But on that note, we will be seeing you guys next week as we talk about Shotgun Jane Doe. We want to go ahead and send our thanks to Zach Bebo over at Bebo Studios. Also, we want to thank Crime Time Nerds, a sister podcast, and CrimeWatchers.net as our sponsors for today. So with that being said, Nick, once again, thank you for blessing me with your voice on this show. It's always a pleasure.
As is yours, Jason. I'm glad we got to get this all recorded in one night, and I think we came up with a good end result, for sure.
Oh, same here. I'm happy with it. But yeah, other than that, folks, so we'll see you on the next episode of From the Vault.